This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in January.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with Cache Valley residents Nick and Melanie Herman. We're going to tell Nick's story, including living with a brain injury, neuroplasticity, vocational rehabilitation, neighborhood housing solutions, and low-level light therapy. Nick is married with three children. He lives with his family in a home in Smithfield built with sweat equity through the Neighborhood and Housing Solutions Program. And he started a business, Infrared Bed, with the help through a grant from Vocational Rehab. A lot of moving parts there, all unified by Nick. Nick Herman, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Tom.
People may remember Nick used to work
here
at UPR.
Yeah,
it's some good days there. And Melanie Herman, his mother, is with us.
Hello, Tom.
Good to have you with us. We had you on with Dr. Norman Doige about 11 years ago now.
Yes.
Talking about neuroplasticity. We're going to talk about that as well. Let me start with Melanie. This all begins with Nick's birth. I mean, in more ways than one, right? Nick is born. We're going to talk about him. But there were problems that manifested themselves.
Nick was born three months prematurely, at birth was doing wonderfully well. 2 days later, the ventilator pressures were too high, and he blew some holes in his lungs. They blew some holes in his lungs, which filled up his chest cavity with air, so his heart wasn't able to beat. And he went CPR on him for over 30 minutes, and he was on 100% oxygen, and we really thought we were going to lose him. And through miracles and blessings, and he survived that. A few days later, they did a CAT scan of his brain, and he had suffered quite a severe brain hemorrhage, probably during that episode when he was in code. So, you know, I was a young mother. I had one daughter that was almost two, or was two, and didn't know much about the brain injury or anything. I do remember the nurse, as they were doing a checkup, follow-up ultrasound of his brain, just saying that, kind of gasping, there's a piece of his brain that's gone. That wasn't exciting to hear, and I really didn't know what that meant. But your brain, as blood dissolves, it takes brain tissue with it. So as his brain hemorrhage actually healed, he did have hydrocephalus and had a shunt placed, but as it healed, it took brain tissue with it. So, it was a waiting game. Seeing the doctors said to us, if he ever sits up, if he ever walks, if he ever feeds himself, things like that. It was a journey of waiting and patience and trying to have faith and praying for the best outcomes.
Mm. So you were given some, I guess, potential expectations that he wouldn't do this and he wouldn't do that, mm-hmm. probably, right?
Yeah.
What was your reaction to that? What, I imagine you look around for help, you do some research. I don't know what your
reaction
is.
Right. Well, you don't want to hear that. That's mm-hmm. nothing any parent would want to hear. And so what you do is you have faith and then you go to work. My background was in early childhood education, and I just really focused on enriching Nick's environment very early on. And, of course, you love them, and you adapt to what they need, and that kind of becomes your life until you have more children, which we did. But we enriched his environment. We did every intervention early on that we could think of or that we found. And Nick progressed. I mean, he didn't walk till he was almost two. One thing that we learned is that when your physical development isn't happening normally, you can progress in other areas. And so Nick was very smart. He read when he was three, started reading. He could memorize words. I labeled his bedroom, everything with words. Wall, ceiling, door, light switch. We had a train that my husband built a track to go around his room so his eyes could track the train, and all the cars were labeled, and then I'd write little stories and use those words in books. And So, you know, just did everything to my knowledge and with whatever research I did to help him, but didn't know a lot, you know, through those early years.
You just have to educate yourself, right?
And, oh, yeah.
And move forward with faith, as you said. So, Nick, you're just a kid, right?
Yeah.
What was your perception of this? What did your parents and others tell you? You had a condition or what?
Yeah, just said I had a brain injury, and this is probably, I mean, my earliest memory was probably like maybe 4 or 5, and you know, I didn't know how a brain injury works, you know, and one of the things that I remember early on, I don't know if I was in kindergarten or first grade, but I remember I was just being a rambunctious little kid, and I remember I was pretending to be a dinosaur in the middle of lunch, you know, and I end up, you know, headbutting a sixth grader, and the sixth grader, you know, obviously pushed me down or whatever. Like, these memories, this is one memory I can think of. And I just remember sitting there like, why did he push me? Like, I didn't know why, you know, he pushed me. I thought I was just, you know, being funny. And a lot of, you know, just I would do things that, you know, today now I realize were probably not socially acceptable, you know, back then. But as a preschool kindergartner, how are you supposed to know, you know? Mm-hmm. It was just things like that. I would do things that were questionable, but I always thought that they were just normal because, you know, I'm a little kid. I'm being silly. There were a lot of social interactions that I did not understand, I guess. And I learned later in life, you know, how my brain injury kind of works. Another memory I had, and I continue to go through, is just growing up and not having a lot of friends. And it's probably because I didn't know how to socialize correctly. And so I ended up not having very many friends. I did have one friend that I met in second grade, and we were pretty much brothers till I was about, I think the last time I saw him was when I was 17 years old, and then we just kind of, he and I kind of lost contact. I still keep in contact with his family, however, but just things like that. Like I didn't have any, very many friends. I wouldn't say I have a best friend. I just say I have acquaintances. Like, I know people, but, you know, I'm not particularly buddy-buddy with them. And it was probably just the fact that, you know, I'm worried about, as I was growing up, I'm worried about, you know, if I'm going to do something stupid or react in a way that's not socially acceptable that I didn't understand at the time, but now, you know, now I kind of get a general idea. And so, yeah, I was just kind of like, you know, I'm kind of going to just stick to myself. I was always, you know, the quiet kid. People would go out and have fun, playing with friends or things like that. Like, I remember in the summer when I was a kid in, you know, the 90s, it would just be like, okay, it's, you know, the summer evening, we're all going to go out and just run around at dark and, you know, explore the neighborhoods, do crazy things like that. And people are like, my mom and dad would be like, you should go. And I'd be like, no, I think I'm good. I think I'm okay. And what they probably didn't realize at the time was just like, I don't want to mess up. I don't want to go out there and, like I said, do something that maybe silly to others, or maybe normal to me, but like I said, silly to others. And I feel super embarrassed about that. Mm. And so I just, you know what, I'm going to just hang out by myself. Mm. And there would be times where I would call this friend up that I told about earlier, and, you know, I'd be like, hey, I know you live half hour away or 10 minutes away or something. You know, like, come over, spend the night, and we'll just hang out. It would just be me and him. And he was the best friend, my best friend. He was my brother. And, you know, looking back on it, I wish I could talk to him, and, you know, hopefully he's listening. I mean, his family's in Cedar City. I don't know where he's located at, but I mean, just me and him were like, it was probably one of the best memories of my life. Mm. You know, coming from somebody that is like, oh yeah, you're disabled, you're different, you have a brain injury, you're gonna struggle, like, and my friend Kelton, he didn't see it that way. We did projects throughout school. We did a school project on humpback whales. We did a whole video. We pretended to be, I don't know if kids today will know these guys, but the Kratt brothers, Chris Kratt, Martin Kratt, they are animal, you know, zoologists, I guess you could say is probably the right term in this moment, but they, you know, they study animals and things like that. And I would grow up watching their shows, and just, you know, just being like, this is cool. And another, yeah, like I said, we did a school project where we did a video on humpback whales. That was our project in fourth grade. So, I mean, just little things like that. He and I were definitely inseparable. And so I was okay with not having a bunch of friends. I was okay with just having that one friend that would be like, hey, I'm kind of having a hard day, or, hey, let's just hang out. And he'd be okay with that. So, I mean, that's one memory I have growing up. And throughout my life, it's always been that kind of thing. It's like, I don't want to say something that will sound weird to people. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to have that conversation, have a conversation and just have it like people kind of lose interest because I babble. I talk a lot. But that's one thing I learned about my brain injury, is like, to help myself kind of understand it and focus on it, I just need to talk. I mean, you don't have to listen. You don't have to care, but it helps me, with the brain injury. It helps me kind of just be calm, because I have, with the brain injury, I have severe anxiety and severe depression. I don't know why that is. And, you know, just to get me through the day, it's just like, okay, I'm just gonna be as calm as possible. I'm okay with just being myself and being on my own, kind of a thing. Anyway.
Great. Yeah, thank you. So, Melanie, turn to you. Nick's talked about some of the difficulties that he had, and I'm, you know, you're there coaching him, helping him, right? Yeah. And thankfully, had a friend or two there that helped. I'm sure as you get closer to adulthood, as a mother, you're worrying.
Oh yeah.
How's Nick gonna make a living? How's Nick gonna survive in this world? Right? Is Nick gonna have a normal life? Married and get children. Well, spoiler alert, you did
get
married and have children, right? But tell me about some of those worries as a mother as Nick goes along.
Well, I didn't identify his kind of the manifestations of his brain injury where he has left-sided cerebral palsy. And so he has very limited use of his left hand, a slight limp. I mean, it's not severe. In comparison to many people with cerebral palsy, but it is debilitating and has been difficult as far as employment. On the other hand, so that's a physical outcome of his brain injury. He also has a cognitive mental outcome, which is called nonverbal learning disorder, and that's kind of a spatial or organizational challenge. Also, the ability to read nonverbal cues is a challenge. And so when Nick says about his social interactions with people, he may not, for as a teenager, as a child, he didn't understand humor or sarcasm. And as he's gotten older, that's something that he gets now. But that was, we knew that that was a challenge that he had that comes with nonverbal learning disorders. When someone's sarcastic, you take it very literally. It's not funny. It's not fun to be the brunt of a joke or not to get a joke and everybody laughs, but you just don't get it. Or you get it maybe a few minutes after. Nick would say, you know, when I've got the joke and I want to see everyone respond, everybody's moved on. That was a thing that he was hard for him and struggled with. You know, interesting thing, though, Nick was a hard worker and he also gets things done like right away. Like in college, he graduated from Utah State University. He attended LDS Business College and then transferred here and got his bachelor's in communications. Worked hard. If a paper was assigned, he couldn't just relax until that was done, even if it was a week or two early. He just had to get that off of his plate. So he probably worked harder, triple harder. than other students, but he did ended up doing well in college, had challenges along the way with politics and faculty and getting into a program when he had all the qualifications, but they had a limited number of spots, and he had to fight his way kind of through some of those things. And then he had jobs that he was overqualified for, but because processing speed wasn't quite there as a typical brain. Then in the moment of stress or maybe problem solving, that's a tough spot where you're trying to process all the incoming information. And if you have a brain injury, some parts of your brain aren't processing well. And so it takes a little longer. So when they say, oh, we want someone quick on the job, you got to be a problem solver. You have to, in the minute, know what you're going to do. He had a stint with did pretty well with Vivint for a while.
Yeah.
But he had customers that would call and yell at him. And then when someone's upset, then what you do is you shut down. You go in defense mode, especially if you have a brain injury. So it's like you just back off. You're silent. You close up because you can't deal with the emotion. But, you know, growing up, Nick was always the model student. He was the student through junior high that the teacher said he's never a problem. He does his work. He sits in his desk. You know, probably he was just trying to manage life. But he was also very sensitive. If a teacher was frustrated with the class, he takes it very personally, so he thinks that teacher is mad at me. That's one kind of nonverbal characteristic of nonverbal
exactly.
learning disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Or other, there's on the opposite end, there's people that you can be yelling in their face and they don't get it, that you're angry. They can't. Anyway, so that's his kind of cognitive deficit. So when you take those two, can you get a hard labor manual job?
No.
He tried. So for a period, maybe, I don't know if you want to tell him about Mr. Car Wash, but for a period I employed him Still do. He majored in communications, but he also got a media design certificate at Bridgeland, and he makes videos. And I came up with content for him and employed him for, I don't know, it's been five or six years.
5 or 6 years.
Yeah. To make videos. And it's actually a brain-based early reading program that's multimodal, and it's called Sing, Move, Read. And he's probably made 250 videos. We also have a Jesus Songs and Stories. That's a real personal channel. And there's stories about challenges.
Mm. Well, let's continue the story after a break. Let's take it overdue for a break. I want to continue the story. We're talking about Nick Herman, also talking with him. He's here with us. And his mother, Melanie Herman. Nick sustained a brain injury at birth, and he's been dealing with it, of course, through life. We get into talking about neuroplasticity, voc rehab, neighborhood housing solutions, and low-level light therapy. And Nick has a business now in the low-level light therapy area. It's called Infrared Bed. And you can find him at infraredbed.co. Let's take a break. More following this.
Flowers are more than decorative. They promote pollination and also preserve the genetic lines of plants. But when did these attractive structures first arise?
The physical first flower is like a holy grail, and it's been a bit of a holy grail since Darwin.
Can we find evidence of the ancestor of all flowers? And could we also improve on chlorophyll? It's Flower Power on Big Picture Science.
Tune in Sunday morning at 11 here on UPR.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members, and support for Spanish language programming is made possible by the USU Office of Global Engagement, sending USU students to high-impact learning experiences in South America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. Learn more about programs at studyabroad.usu.edu. This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in January.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Cache Valley residents Nick and Melanie Herman. We're telling Nick's story. He's living with a brain injury. We're going to get into talking about neuroplasticity, vocational rehabilitation, neighborhood housing solutions, low-level light therapy. Nick has a business in that area. It's called Infrared Bed. You can find that at infraredbed.co. So, Melanie Herman, you were talking about before the break. Nick's somewhat limited in what he can do as a job, right? He can't do hard physical labor because of the cerebral palsy, right?
Right.
Yep.
And some limitations because of the brain injury,
right?
As well. Mm-hmm. So, I guess at some point you look into the voc rehab. Is that what you did?
Mm-hmm.
You guys?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I went into vote. It's been quite a bit of a process. I went in to vocational rehab, voc rehab, probably once or twice. The second time that I went in, we had discussed what could help me with, either trying to find a job or, how can I work and, support my family. And they came up with, they have a business option where you're eligible if you have a disability that causes your ability to keep a job, work certain types of jobs. And then you're assigned a counselor, and you create kind of an education / business plan of what you want to do. And I don't know that we started this like last April. Is that right, Mom?
It's been a long.
Yeah, it's been quite
24,
a while.
24, probably.
Yeah, April 2024 is when I went in for my second time. They do have a self-employment track which is this, what I'm trying to get to is that, you know, you create a business plan with the help of my father, who, you know, works here at Utah State in the business college, as well as my mom. We were able to create a business plan and talk with this counselor about it, which was, you know, the low-level light therapy, or as people probably know it, red light therapy. And we just, you know, we would do our due diligence, you know, do research on how it's going to affect the community. Will it be able to bring people in so, you know, I can support my family, my wife and three kids, and just, you know, how the financials will work out and things like that. Once we were able to talk about, you know, all that, all the things that you're supposed to do, your due diligence, you know, financials, how your business plan is going to work, where are you going to, you know, where's your location going to be, what will work for you, kind of a thing. If you get approved, you get a certain amount of funding. The funding that I did, I got up to $35,000 in a grant to help me start my business. So I was able to, like, but I was, like I said, like, you can't just go spend it willy-nilly. You have to talk to vocational rehab about, you know, what you need and if they're going to approve it. So with the lights that we use at my business, we had to go through platinum LED. That's the lights that we use. And, you know, just things like that. It's just like, okay, we need a couple of these. They're going to be a certain amount of money, like 11 something like that. And it's just, you have to get approval. And Voc Rehab will be like, okay, we'll work with these companies that you know, you need to buy stuff from. And a lot of it was Amazon. A lot of it was, you know, Platinum LED and things like that. And I was able to slowly get the business up and running. I did a lot of the office set up with my mom and my dad. My dad and I spent a lot of hours, you know, building temporary walls in this building that we were able to procure, the gym that was there that had those open space. You know, they said, we heard about, you know, you're doing this, and we're very excited to have you next to us, kind of a thing. So we were able to, you know, get that put together. Yeah, and I've been up and running since October. So.
Yeah, well, congratulations. Yeah,
thank you.
Infrared bed.co is the place to go. Yeah. Melody Herman, tell us a little bit about low-level light therapy.
Well, I first learned or heard about it on an airplane on my way to North Carolina to a neurofeedback training. And it was in Chapter 4 of Norman Doidge's second book, The Brain's Way of Healing. And when I read that chapter, it was like, made perfect sense to me. It was like, light heals. And I know who the source of light and truth is, and light heals. And so it was just like the science backing up what I already knew. And so we started using light panels. I actually reached out to Michael Hamblin, who is a professor and a physician in Boston and Harvard, and now he's at the University of Johannesburg. But he is a researcher in photomedicine and photobiomodulation, and he was doing a study on brain injury and low-level light therapy. I reached out to him, and surprisingly, he responded right away. I was just wondering. I said, I have an adult son. He's had this brain injury for 26 years. is there still improvement that can be made for his brain? And he said, yes, but you don't have to come to Boston for my study. You can use devices at home, LEDs. And he was so kind. He directed us to panels that were the best bang for the buck, you know, because you could go online and you can look up low-level light therapy or red light therapy devices. And this was 10, 11 years ago. 12 years ago. So we've been using it for a long time, kind of like right before it exploded. And he directed us to these light panels, and we used them in our family, and everybody used them. Everybody fought over them. Where was the light panel? Who needed? Nick used them for his brain. We used them for all sorts of injuries. My dream back then was like, oh man, wouldn't it be great to have a business where you had all these panels and they would hang over your entire body? I researched full body light beds 10 years ago, and there, I found one in New York, and it was like $100,000, and I thought, oh, that would be the dream. But now, you know, it was pretty exciting to, as we're trying to come up with ideas for Nick, to use a therapy that actually helped him a lot and benefited our family, and to find that because of technology and advancements in technology, you can now get full body light panels, light beds. And then we had to go into this research, the science and what makes them different or more powerful, one device from another. And we found that some of the beds that were the fancy, like the Cadillac of light beds, didn't have the irradiance rating that really heavy duty panels had. So a lot of research went into that and finding the ones that were most affordable, most powerful, most effective for healing all sorts of things in the body. So what low-level light therapy does is it penetrates through the skin. The panels that Nick uses in his business have 7 wavelengths of light, which is very unique. Also, most panels have 2 or 3 today. His have 7, and they could go down deep. The infrared panels penetrate into muscles and tendons and tissue. They help with all sorts of internal healing. But the most exciting is at the cellular level, what they do for inflamed cells and how they clear out the nitric oxide, and they they allow the cells that are inflamed to get the oxygen they need to heal and restore and regenerate. And so it's really helping your deep down in your cells, for your brain, in your neurons. It helps with cognition. I mean, I could just go on and on. I don't know how much detail you really want, but it's really exciting. And with all the therapies that we did with Nick, and we've done many, I just knew that the help that we were going to get was dependent on our efforts. So we've tried a lot of things there are a lot of amazing things out there to help people with brain injury or other kind of deficits and challenges. Seems like light was a universal answer to so many needs. You know, it's interesting too that the beauty industry and the anti-age, they went up for anti-aging, all these things, but we were there for the deeper levels, for the functioning and the pain and the sleep and headaches and depression, anxiety, because light helps your brain too. It helps your neurons it helps with sleep, helps with depression, anxiety. Every time your body is flooded with cortisol or adrenaline, that stores in your body, and that can inflame your cells and your neurons, which then makes it very difficult when you deal with depression or anxiety. There are studies now with autism, and this is super exciting. I know Nick's posted some articles on autism on his site, but to start using it with our grandson, Nick's
My son Luca. It's his birthday, so happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Luca.
Years old, and he's had some light sessions, but we're excited to see what that can do with improving his symptoms that come with autism. But yeah. I don't know if there's more specific.
That was good. Yeah. It's just kind of a sketch of what this is. And then, of course, Nick, that's what you do. So infrared bed.co. infrared bed.co is Nick's business. You can go, you're in Smithfield, right?
Yep. Smithfield.
And, you can make an appointment here on the website and take advantage of this. So that's Nick's business, infrared bed.co. neuroplasticity.co. Let's take another break. When we come back, we'll tell more of Nick's story. We'll talk about neuroplasticity and the Neighborhood Housing Solutions Program. That's another part of Nick's story, sweat equity. And we were talking before we went on the air, anecdotally, just about every person that I've talked to over the last, I don't know, several months, who's gotten into a house has used this program. Yes. It's the housing is so tough these days. This is a way into housing. So we'll talk about that as well. We'll have more following this break.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
we sail the brilliant blue waters of the world's largest inland sea, with ports of call in Spain, Italy, Morocco, Greece, Egypt, and beyond. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for a Mediterranean cruise on the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Thursday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
It's songs for Easter, Passover, and spring, hoping to prevail through tough times with the voices of Aretha Franklin, Bessie Smith, Dr. John, and Fats Domino. We'll hear the sacred steel of Fran Grace and Nikki D. Brown, and witness the Easter rock ritual in Winnsboro, Louisiana, on American Roots from PRX.
Tune in Saturday evening at 8 here on UPR.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in January.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah today. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Cache Valley residents Nick and Melanie Herman. We're telling Nick Herman's story. He sustained a brain injury at birth, and he's been living with that. Manifests some physically and some kind of invisible, some of these invisible injuries as well. And we were talking about vocational rehabilitation. Nick was able to get a grant to launch his business, which, by the way, is infraredbed.co. And we talked a little bit about what he does, the kind of the science of low-level light therapy. So let's continue with Nick's story. I want to just kind of, on a personal level, Nick, you've mentioned one of the kind of the byproducts of your injury. Mm-hmm. Is anxiety, depression, you've really struggled with social cues and very isolating in your childhood, right?
Yes.
Really had to fight for things that you've wanted.
And I still do.
For sure, still have to fight for these things. I guess speaking to people who are in a similar situation to you, what gives you hope? At this current point, what has given you hope, and what do you think would give hope to a person in your similar situation?
I'd have to say before I got married and had kids, I'd just be like, keep pushing forward, do what you can for, yourself. But then, after I got married, and then after, after we lost our first son, and then shortly after that, Luca was born, and this just seeing him being able to progress and, do things that, surprised me. It would just be like, okay, a father with a brain, a cerebral palsy and a brain injury, raising a son that has a chromosome disorder and autism that's manifested itself. It's just like, don't give up. The best thing I can say is just don't give up. As hard as that is, just don't give up. Keep pushing forward. I know there are families out there that, have kids with certain challenges, and, I don't know if the right, I don't know if the right term is disabilities, but, that's what I know, that just don't give up and, you know, have patience. And, you know, there are a lot of positive things that, you know, these that I've been going through, and that these my son Luca has, it's just been amazing. And a lot of the times it's just like, there are a lot of days where I want to be like, you know, I just want to shut down for today. You know, I'm done. I'm tired. But then just being able to see Luca with his brother and his sister, playing together. It's so funny because, my two younger children, Gus and Blakely, they're 10 months apart, and they just absolutely love playing with each other, but they always include Luca. It's so funny because we have in our house, we have right now, our basement is unfinished, but we converted it to like this massive play area where the kids can go downstairs and just have the time of their life. So they have a swing, they have a swing, they have a slide, they have chairs, they have a whole bunch of toys. And it's just funny to hear them talk about, hey, let's go downstairs. And the way Luca says it is, Gus, go play downstairs, or Luca or Blakely, go play downstairs. And, you know, his siblings would be like, yeah, let's go play downstairs. And next thing you know, they're all downstairs by themselves, just having a blast, laughing, enjoying themselves. And just being able to see Luca, you know, progress with his siblings. And he's in kindergarten right now. And my hope is that, you know, he'll be able to have friends that will be able to look past his struggles and what he's dealing with, and just be able to have a good time with him.
Yeah.
So I'd have, like I was saying before, just don't give up. Things are, you know, they may seem hard now, but as long as you go from this morning to the way I see it is going from, okay, I'm going to wake up in the morning, I'm just going to go in an increment. I'm just going to take my day in an increment of 5 to 10 minutes. Mm. Okay, I survive that 10 minutes. Okay, on to the next 10. So just basically don't give up and just take things as they come. And as stressful as that is with somebody with a brain injury or struggles of that nature, just take it as best you can.
Yeah, that's great advice. Melanie Herman, I want to ask you the same question. You have a son who suffers this brain injury, right? And now you're thrust into this new world, right? Seems like you've just tried to go forward and try everything you can. What would be your advice to parents, people in similar situation?
I would say, intervene as soon as you can. I work with people of all ages. I do neurofeedback, and which is another tool to help with brain function and optimization. And I've worked with teenagers, for example, I've talked to parents who about their children when they're very young, but maybe they don't want to invest the time or the energy in an intervention that may or may not have the results that they hope for. And so they wait, and then that child grows and they're a teenager. And while you have control over your child, I would start interventions very early. I've worked with teenagers that are kind of drowning in computer addiction, gaming addictions. And they really, at that point, they don't have the desire to change. And if someone says something, oh, I'm seeing some sort of improvement or whatever, then they immediately have pulled back because they're comfortable in what they are, and their parent might really want them to be healed or to progress past this addiction or obsession. But they don't have that control because now they're really exerting their will. But a young child, you can do things early on, and the earlier you do it, the better, because you're gonna help their junior high years and their high school years and their college years. And I would have people, after the Norman Doidge event, we would have people calling and saying, oh, it's now that we know there's a Santa Claus, how do we get him to stop at our house? And what they were saying, we read about all these wonderful interventions, but I don't know how to implement it in my family. And so they would call me for advice. And some of them would say, if I do this, will my child be, quote, normal? And I would just honestly, no, they won't, but they will improve. You will see progress, and then you're ready for the next intervention. And will this help your child? Yes. So you just keep going. You know, you try this, and there's improvements and gains, and we've seen that with Nick. I mean, if you really saw the MRI of his brain, you would say he is missing a big chunk of his brain. And thanks to God for this neuroplastic brain that he's given us that can change despite missing pieces, right?
Right. So neuroplasticity, we've referenced this several times. We did a program 10 years ago. This is the brain's ability to rewire itself, right? Mm-hmm. To kind of heal itself.
Yeah. So, and for neuroplastic change to occur, there are three, Dr. Doidge identified three. I added one to that, but there's frequency. Okay, our thoughts and behaviors can actually change the structure of our brain. They can change our thoughts and the structure of our brains. But you have to do something frequently enough for a long enough period of time. So that's frequency and duration. And then you have to have intensity, which is slightly pushing a push or a shove above your comfort level. So in some of the brain training programs that I do, you're pushing them to they're on that edge of discomfort. It's like working out at a gym where you got to put some muscle into this, right? So you have intensity. And then the thing that I've added to my list is in my experience as a teacher and also as a brain trainer and a neuroplastic practitioner is engagement. They have to be engaged. So if you have young children that are struggling, you have to do something that's engaging for them, that they want to do it enough that they get the repetition, the duration, the intensity, the engagement, and then they're able to succeed with reading or with whatever it might be. You know, but even as an adult, changing our thoughts, if we have thoughts that are negative and despairing about ourselves and we think those continually, we're wiring our brain that way. But if we change, if we recognize, so it's mindfulness coming in, we recognize when we're in that negative thought pattern, we stop the pattern, we replace the thoughts with something that is hopeful, happier, and healthy, and then we persist at that, and it's going to take some time because you have to have frequency, duration, and intensity. You have to control your thoughts, basically. You have to recognize what you're thinking, then you have to do something about it, and then you have to hold on to that for long enough, and your brain can be tired, like literally exhausted trying to stop a negative thought pattern or something. But over time, your brain can change to a healthier, happier, more hopeful brain.
Yeah.
You know, the exciting thing, though, mm-hmm. it even changes your genes. And Dr. Doidge talks about this. So as you change the structure of your brain, you're actually changing your genes, which will affect your future children.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, we're almost out of time, just a minute or two left. I just want to give a shout-out to, since we've mentioned it several times, the Neighborhood Nonprofit Housing Corporation. And you can find them at nnhc.org, nnhc.org. This is Nick. This is what you took advantage of, right?
Yep.
Sweat equity.
You don't have to pay a down payment for the first month. You come together with a family, with a group of eight families and build each other's houses. It's funded by the USDA. The mortgage payment is as low as 1%. Mm-hmm. Which is crazy in today's world.
It is, yeah.
And you basically just build a community. You are required to work on your house 35 hours a week.
Okay.
And
you're in your house now?
Yeah, I've been in my house since April 2025.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful. Yeah, I just wanted to give a shout out to that. This is a way. One of the few ways people are getting into houses these days. So
yeah.
I'm glad you took advantage of that. NNHC.org. Well, just here at the end, Nick, shout out to your business.
Yeah.
So congratulations, InfraredBed.co. infraredbed.co. I guess you just go to the website and
yeah, we go to,
how do you?
You go to the website and you schedule an appointment. We have slots open. We are doing specials. We have an unlimited access pass, $150 a month, minimum of 3 months. And then we have punch passes. So you buy a 10-session punch pass, you get a free month at the gym that's next to us that let us use the space, United Athletic Conditioning. Shout out to them.
And Nate Rubens.
And then you can also, if you buy a gym membership, you get 2 free light therapy sessions.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So once again, infraredbed.co. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Nick. Nick Herman.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for brings back some good memories.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Announcing here for us.
Yeah.
And congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Everything that you've been doing. Melanie Herman, his mother, has been with us as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Okay, excellent. All right, and LPE, just want to verify we have no open constraints at this time.
No open constraints. We have a clear board, sir.
Okay, tracking the same here. And launch director, with that, we are clear and ready to pick up the launch readiness poll with your go.
All right, NTD, I copy all. At this time, I'll perform my poll. Attention on the net. This is the launch director performing the final poll for launch. Verify no constraints and go for launch. EGF, EGS, program chief engineer.
Artemis chief engineers are go.
Copy, thank you. EGS, chief safety officer.
The Artemis CSOs are go.
Copy, thank you. Range weather.
Launch weather is go.
Thank you, LWO and Artemis MMT chair.
MMTs go.
Thank you, John. And Integrity Launch Director.
Good hear your voice, Charlie. DLT.
Thank you, Charlie. This is Victor. We are rolling for our families.
MS1.
This is Christina. We are going for our teammates.
MS2.
This is Jeremy. We are going for all humanity.
All right, Charlie. Your Artemis 2 crew is go for launch. Full send.
I copy that. Reed, Victor, Christina, and Jeremy, on this historic mission, you take with you the heart of this Artemis team, the daring spirit of the American people and our partners across the globe, and the hopes and dreams of a new generation. Good luck. Godspeed, Artemis 2. Let's go. And into the launch director.
If all goes well, they will fly by it in 6 days. TLS is go for 4 stages to internal power. All right, there's the rocket's core stage, which houses 3 flight computers, is now on its own power.
1 minute.
Right now, the rocket does not know what the T0 is, but coming up at T-minus 33 seconds, control shifts from the ground launch sequencer to the rocket's onboard autonomous launch sequencer, or ALS. The rocket will count itself down, but honor any holds that could come from the ground. Now, shortly after liftoff, Houston will take control of the rocket, and my colleague Gary Jordan will take over commentary.
TLS, go for ALS.
Great call out. The rocket is on its own. 4 brave explorers ready to ride the most powerful rocket NASA has ever launched. Sound suppression water is flowing.
15.
And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition. And liftoff. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Good roll pitch.
Roger, roll pitch.
Houston, now controlling the flight of Integrity on the Artemis 2 mission.
Hey.
Integrity, ALS
2 high.
On time, passing 30 seconds into the flight. Integrity passes the ultimate eagle. Target milestone, Mission Control Houston said good performance on coordinated engines. Space Launch System core stage. Integrity, 3 miles in altitude. Traveling more than 1,200 miles per hour. Wiseman and pilot Victor Glover overseeing the deployment of the solar arrays, and we'll follow the attitude maneuver changes ahead of the first burn of the ICBS engine, the perigee raise maneuver.
Sanitary Houston, we see 4 SAWs deployed and latched, ready for ATO preferred.
Skywatcher Leo T, where it's one sky, many cultures, as we head off into outer space toward the moon. Way to go, Artemis.